today is to give you a more detailed summary of where we stand in cosmology. And in particular, my goal is to try to give you an honest assessment as I can, as to both what I feel we do know and what I feel we don't know. As you know, it's very fashionable to assume that there is some stuff called dark matter, some stuff called dark energy, that inflation happened, and people parameterize the properties of these postulated things with some parameters, and they fit for them. I think it's very important to always test one's assumptions in physics, and that's why I want to focus very much on elucidating what it is we actually measure, and how we can use data to test, rather than just assume the underlying physics. So, to start off with, it's of course a really fun time to talk about cosmic maps and cosmic measurements, particularly this year since my Swedish countrymen finally realized that this is actually cool stuff and gave a Nobel Prize to the subject. So you've all, and of course, partly because of this, cosmic micro background gets very much talked about. But I think it's important to remember that there's much more to cosmology than the cosmic micro background. And I want to emphasize throughout the talk that there's a whole host of other areas of observation which have also really blossomed in recent years and transformed cosmology from what used to be a very data-starved rather philosophical area of research into real precision subject. So what have we learned so far from cosmological measurements? Let me start off here by just showing you a more modern map of the galaxy distribution than the one that we looked at yesterday. This is from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, the most ambitious three-dimensional mapping project so far. And the voice in the background you're going to hear narrating this is my colleague Josh Friedman from Fermilab.
Our story begins on a blue planet called Earth.
Can you hear that in the back?
On the North American continent, in the United States, in southern New Mexico, home of Apache Point Observatory, site of the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. Inside this structure is a 2.5 meter telescope, which is being used to construct the largest map of the universe ever made. When the survey is completed in the next few years, it will provide a three-dimensional atlas of nearly a million galaxies. Let's take a look at what they have found so far. We begin our journey about 2 light years away from the Earth, looking back at the Sun. A light year is just the distance that light ray travels in 1 year, about 6 trillion miles. Moving outward, we see thousands of nearby stars, many of them just like our own Sun. These stars are part of a much larger spiral-shaped collection of 100 billion stars, a galaxy called the Milky Way. Moving outward from the Milky Way, we begin to see the nearest galaxies mapped by the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. The Sloan Survey records the images of galaxies using a giant camera and later measures light from each galaxy in more detail using an instrument called a spectrograph. We are now tens of millions of light years from Earth. Galaxies come in a variety of shapes, sizes, and colors, from typical blue spiral galaxies like our own Milky Way to giant red elliptical or oval-shaped galaxies. Now hundreds of millions of light years from Earth, we see that galaxies collect together in groups ranging from a few galaxies to great clusters containing many hundreds of galaxies to large web-like structures stretching across hundreds of millions of light years. The survey is being carried out in thin slices across the sky, like pieces of a watermelon. When completed, these slices will merge together to form a three-dimensional map of the universe. Cosmologists believe that these large-scale structures evolved from small ripples in the fabric of space, generated a tiny fraction of a second after the Big Bang, about 14 billion years ago. Beyond the Sloan Survey, we reach the cosmic microwave background radiation, as mapped by NASA's WMAP satellite. This radiation gives us a picture of the universe when it was only 400,000 years old.
The colored patches show directions on the sky where the temperature is slightly hotter and cooler than average. By analyzing and comparing the data from these different kinds of surveys, cosmologists are closing in on a consistent picture of how the universe evolved from its earliest moments to the present day.
So as I mentioned very briefly yesterday, the key picture that's emerged from a host of cosmological measurements so far in terms of the history of the universe can be summarized like so. And as I also mentioned yesterday, there are two separate processes that have been going on here, both the expansion and the clumping. Okay? And in terms of taking a step back and asking, what is it we really know? It's very helpful to separate those two in your mind. So if we make an assumption that there's a metric theory of gravity at low energy, so that there is a metric, then I would put to you that pretty much all measurements made in cosmology can be cast in terms of having measured the metric, measured certain aspects of the metric. You use photons as test particles to find out what null geodesics are like. You use massive test particles like stars and galaxies to figure out other geodesics, and we try to construct what the metric has done. And then, after that, we can make a whole bunch of other assumptions if we want to get into dark energy, dark matter, and such things. Okay? Now, what do we know about the metric empirically? We know from observation that we're very, very close to a Friedmann-Robertson-Walker metric. The universe is homogeneous and isotropic to the level of about 10 to minus 5. That's an observation in this spherical volume that we can observe. So what is there to measure in the Friedmann-Robertson-Walker metric? Well, if I can find a piece of chalk, take a look. So the Friedmann-Robertson-Walker metric, of course, as you all know, it's just dt squared minus the scale factor a of t squared times the quantity vr squared, one is 1 minus jr squared, plus r squared, and then some angular stuff. And what is there that needs to be measured here? It's this one function of time, a of t, the cosmic scale factor, which you can think of as up to a proportionality constant, the distance between these two co-moving objects, say two distant galaxies, as a function of time. Are they accelerating away from each other or moving away from each other slower and slower? But what exactly are they doing? We would like to measure just this function, a of t. Usually people parameterize this function in some way and then measure the parameters, but in fact, the data are getting better and better, and we really would love to just measure the whole curve or plot the curve, see what it looks like. Okay. The second thing we would like to measure is this constant here, which tells us whether space is positively curved, negatively curved, or flat. And that's it. To zero the order. If we neglect the perturbations, we just want to measure the expansion history. The lowest order, we want to measure A of T, how the universe has expanded over time, and also, space is curved or not. And one can also look at the topology of space in one space. Okay, if you take the logarithm of this, log A, and then take the derivative of that with respect to time, that gives you the definition of H, the expansion rate, also known as the Hubble parameter, which is a more convenient thing to actually go out and measure in astrophysics, because it's more linked to what we see. That's the zero order. The first order, we want to look at how the clustering has grown, how we've gradually started to depart more and more from the Friedmann-Robertson-Walker metric. So we want to measure this clustering, or the power, as we call it in cosmology, both as a function of scale, large scales versus small scales, and as a function of time, or redshift, the time clocks that we use in cosmology. And then what we basically try to do is factor this function of two variables into a function only of time, which tells you about what it is that's amplified the clustering, namely the nature of dark matter, dark energy, neutrinos, or whatever else is out there. And then into also a function of scale, which tells you about what the fluctuations were like very early on, and can give you crucial clues as to what really happened early on and made these fluctuations, whether it was inflation or something else. So that's the basic game plan in terms of what to do with these measurements. So let's speak a little bit first about what we know zeroth order of measuring this expansion, this function a of t, where equivalent to h as a function of redshift. Okay? So the basic idea here that enables us to do this at all is that when we look far away in space, we're looking at things that happened in the past. Farther back we look, farther back in time we'll see, right? And for each object we see, we can measure two independent quantities. We can measure both the dimming and the redshift. So in Euclidean space, as you know, things look dimmer according to inverse square law. So if I have a 100-watt light bulb and I look at how bright it appears to me, I can figure out how far away it is from the dimming. Dimming gives me distance. I can also measure the redshift of things. The farther away they are, the faster they're receding, in a sense, and or the more space is expanded since the light was emitted. So things which were originally blue will appear to be more red. So I get two numbers measured for each object. The dimming, which gives a little distance, and then a redshift. And I can plot these two against each other. Edwin Hubble was the first to do that, therefore called the Hubble diagram. And not surprisingly, you get a different prediction for this curve should look for each different function a of t. So what you can do is try to measure that curve really, really accurately and infer back out what that curve is. What is a of t? And you can do it either by measuring using dimming to measure the distances, or by using, which is often known as standard candles in astronomy, or by using a geometric technique, standard rulers. In Euclidean space, if you know that this hockey stick is 1 meter long, and you measure what angle it subtends, you know how far away it is. And this angle will drop in the small angle limit of this 1/distance. Space is curved, but you have, and more generally, this relationship between the angular size and the distance will depend, again, on this function. You can also do it in a third technique involving clocks. And the most famous technique so far, the newest, has been standardizable candles, where your proxy for the 100-watt light bulb is a type 1a supernova, here stolen from Saul Perlmutter's webpage. And by measuring how exactly it gets brighter and dim as a function of time and the spectrum, astronomers can figure out very accurately how luminous it really was, and therefore extract the distance. Look, we can talk a little more later if there's time about a more recent technique using angles instead, measuring a characteristic scale of so-called acoustic oscillations in the galaxy distribution, which complements this very nicely. But the bottom line is all summarized here. From this kind of measurements, okay, of distance versus redshift, here's what we've learned about the expansion history of the universe so far, about this function a of t. So let me first summarize under this whopping log plot here, where scale factor a is plotted over 60 orders of magnitude of expansion up until the present epoch here. And instead of plotting h, the Hubble a dot over a, I'm plotting the square of that, which according to the Friedman equation of general relativity corresponds to the density of the universe. And we see the density has dropped by over 100 orders of magnitude as a result of this cosmic expansion. We know that stuff gets more and more diluted as you expand it into a larger volume. And here is the broad brush picture that's emerged. Rather recently, the slope of this curve is -3. That's the way ordinary stuff gets diluted. If mass is conserved, then you put it into something of twice the radius, the volume is 8 times bigger, so the density is 8 times smaller. Right? 8 to -3. Earlier on, the density of the universe was dominated by relativistic stuff like photons, which not only had their number density diluted like 8 to -3, but they also redshifted. They had their wavelength stretched by 1 power of a. So you get an 8 to minus, you get a -4 slope here during this epoch. Still earlier, if the theory of inflation is correct, the universe was dominated by some kind of substance which was very hard to dilute. Hardly diluted at all as the universe expanded for a long time. Corresponds to exponential expansion. We don't know for sure that this happened, but there are good reasons to think so. We don't know the details of if it happened at this energy or that energy, but this is qualitatively what it would have looked like. And then in recent times, here's a little zoom of detailed measurements of this curve near the present epoch. Okay. this work I did together with Yun Wang, where we put together a lot of micro background and galaxy and supernova observations. The curve does not have slope minus 3 anymore. You get this yellow curve. We know that it must have had slope minus 3 at some point in the past. And if you fit out just the ordinary matter that's there, if you fit out this slope 3 component, the residual of what's left, the other stuff, which you don't know what it is, has a density evolving like the green stuff. We have no idea what this stuff is, so a fancy word has been coined for it, dark energy. And what's really intriguing is to see that with all the newest data, it's consistent with the density of this thing not changing at all with time. It's consistent with this dark energy refusing to dilute. You put it into twice the volume, density is constant, you know, twice the mass of it. Okay. So the thing to take away from it is that since this was first discovered about 6-7 years ago, much better data has been acquired, like what we see here, for instance, and it's still consistent with this being plain old vanilla cosmological constant, something that does not change with time. And the million-dollar question is this stuff constant, or is it not? Is it actually changing with time, density, or not? And is it quantum threat space or not? Lee?
Yeah, just a question on the graph. The green extends under the yellow to the right of near redshift 2.
This is actually today. This is probably, you mean over here?
Yeah.
This is actually toward the future, which we have no clue about since we haven't been there yet.
Oh, I'm sorry, that's not redshift, that's the yeah.
Exactly. This is...
That's now.
Yeah, exactly.
So you must have made some sort of...
Yeah, we did a whole series of different parameterizations to fit the data, and that's why gradually these models say less and less when you extrapolate into the future. But I think what's fair to say is, regardless of what way you parameterize this quote dark energy, we did some very general things with cubic splines, with many points, etc. There's not a shred of evidence yet that it's anything other than constant. Okay? There's no hint of any changes of its density with time. And I think the challenge to the community should be, the observational community should be, rather than assume that it has a constant equation of state or something unphysically motivated, not physically motivated, just look for any departures from constant. And if that is found, it'll be extremely interesting. So I think people should look for that with an open mind. That's where we stand with dark energy. Here's still more data that came in after we made this plot by Adam Reese and his collaborators, when you see the same thing again. Let's look at the bottom plot. This is what vanilla predicts, that the universe has, take this function here, take this time derivative, the rate of expansion has been, this is the past, astronomers love to plot things backwards. Here, the rate of expansion kept dropping, the universe was decelerating, and then gradually, about half of the present age of the universe, it started accelerating again. And you see, this is completely consistent again with this simplest prediction of the cosmological constant. So that's the zeroth order, sort of where we stand. What about first order? What about all this cosmic clustering? Let's turn to that now. And let's see if I move my laptop doesn't seem to want to talk to me so much today. No problem. So. There, what we know is that the universe, as I said, was very uniform and boring early on because the fluctuations we see in the micro background are only at the 10 to minus 5 level. And if you just plot the density field with such small fluctuations on a straight linear scale like this, you wouldn't even be able to see the fluctuations at all. But gradually, over time, gravity amplified these fluctuations, and they grew into the galaxies and the larger structure that we see around us in the universe today. Where each individual blob here corresponds to the location of a galaxy. Now, the very useful way of quantifying this clumpiness, this cosmic clustering that you see here, is to just take this three-dimensional density field and Fourier transform, and then make a plot of the variance as a function of the radius in Fourier space, a function of k. We have a fancy word for variance in cosmology, we call it power. It looks like that. Yes, Lee? Yeah.
What you just showed us was a numerical model or data?
It's actually an interesting hybrid of both. What Mathis, Lemson, and Springer, and Kaufman, and White, and Deckel have done here is they did constrained realization, where they took observations today of where there is stuff, but then added in simulated fluctuations on smaller scales where it hasn't been measured. And then they evolved it backward in time, and then they evolved it forward on the computer. So I think it gives us a nice flavor of purpose that something like this will probably happen, even though, of course, you can't trust the small scale details. So the way we can quantify this is by making a plot of the so-called power spectrum. And I don't know, maybe you've spent your whole life. How old are you? How old are you?
14.
You probably haven't spent an enormous amount of time in school learning about Fourier transforms. Is that right? So for you, for example, you don't have to worry too much about what a Fourier transform is. You can just think of basically this curve is measuring how clumpy the universe is on different scales. Okay. So here we have over 10,000 light years, over 10 billion light years size clumps. And this is telling us over here about how big clumps and how much clumpiness we have on the scale of tens of millions of light years, so the separation between typical galaxies. So it's from, you can think of it crudely as a function of clumping versus scale. And what's really remarkable here is how fast the measurements improve on this plot. So let me just give you a historical flashback. This is 1999. My colleague Michael Vogley gives me this summary of what he feels is known, where different kinds of galaxy clustering measurements disagree with each other by over a factor of 10 here, okay? Gradually, much more ambitious galaxy surveys really helped clean this up. These are measurements that my collaborators and I made with the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, and our colleagues from the 2DF collaboration got beautiful results that agree very well with this. But that's just one technique, looking at the clumping of these galaxies that we looked at a movie of in the beginning of this talk. You can also look at galaxy clusters and see how many there are as a function of redshift and size. And that gives you a point on this, which is consistent. Then you can use the microwave background fluctuations, which we spoke about yesterday, and extend the measurement to much, much larger scales, up to scales corresponding to the size of our observable universe. And you see they agree beautifully with the galaxy's measurements here, where they overlap. And this is something which really has changed in cosmology, in my opinion. Cosmologists have sometimes been described as people who are never in doubt, but often wrong. And those of you who are a little older will remember this whole saga about the Hubble constant being 50 plus minus 3 according to some people, and 100 plus minus 4 according to other people. And it's clear there are all these systematic errors, but everybody's sort of stuck to their position. And so measuring something with small error bars is not very impressive. What's impressive is when you can measure things in very, very different ways and get the same answer. And that's what's finally beginning to happen in this field. If you take the microwave background measurements and plot them in a slightly different way instead of expanding in spherical harmonics, you get a curve that many of you have seen before, which looks like this. And here I'm also plotting some theoretical predictions. So black is data. And the red is a theoretical prediction for the simplest cosmological model of dark matter, dark energy, and inflation. It's a model of 6 free parameters that have been adjusted to fit this. And it's absolutely stunning how good the agreement is where they do these points with actually tiny error bars. And just in contrast, these other curves, each of these other curves are theoretical predictions from theories for which I had at least one colleague who I really respected who believed seriously in 5 years ago. For example, without cold dark matter, without dark energy, cosmic strings. And now it's just stunning to see how they're ruled out at like 100 sigma. Right? This is a testimony to just how fast the measurements have improved. Yes?
You said the green one was without cold dark matter, but now you write without lambda. So I imagine lambda is a cosmological constant.
This is what you get if you have no cosmological constant. Then space must be curved, and you get the first peak way off to the right. The one without dark matter is the one that gives the amplitude of this piece.
Next.
Oh, sorry, I think there might be funny labeling here.
Because your labeling says
about
lambda.
No, so I'm actually saying it wrong. This is not without dark matter. I'm just talking mentally. This is without lambda, but you have the flat universe, so that omega equals 1 in matter. That's what this is. which was called, used to be called standard CDM for many years. And used to be the most popular model among many of my colleagues.
And you don't have a curve for just with lambda, but without cold dark matter.
I can show you. I'll show you that later, actually, in about 5 minutes, okay? And you'll see how that looks. It's very interesting to see how it goes on. I'm not saying this to make fun of my colleagues who put the money on other theories. I'm saying to give credit to the experimentalists for how fast they've improved the measurements. It's really stunning. And it's still better than that, because...
The other models have the same number of 3 parameters?
Well, we have for each model here, I've adjusted the parameters to give as good a fit as you can within that class of models. So there's sometimes one parameter less, but... Well, I'll come back to the interesting question of how many parameters there really are in about 10 minutes. So those are 3 very nice techniques you can do, but there's still more. There's the Lyman alpha forest technique, which burst on the scene about 5 years ago, pioneered by Rupert Croft and others. And what's Lyman alpha forest? Well, basically, if you're here and look at your telescope looking at a distant quasar, you're looking through a whole bunch of hydrogen along the line of sight, which will cause absorption in the spectrum of the quasar, causing all these absorption lines known as the Lyman alpha forest. So the basic idea is then that the clustering of this tells you something about the clustering of that. This is quite a new technique, which has the power of measuring this curve at a much smaller scale. And where it overlaps existing measurements, it agrees really, really well. Again, we've already seen. And there's still more. There's the gravitational lensing technique. Gravitational lensing is, per se, old hat. Einstein was the first to talk about gravitational lensing, and Eddington measured it in 1919, starlight bent by the sun. Right? But what I'm talking about here is, rather, when you point your telescope not at a specific known clump of stuff, like the sun, or a massive cluster of galaxies, getting background images distorted or moved, but rather you point your telescope at just a blank part of the sky, a random part of the sky. The distortion of light, of background light, by foreground matter, the bending of light, will then make things intrinsically, they will make things look more elliptical than they really are. And what you look for is correlations in ellipticities. That's the signal that you pull out. The correlations in ellipticities, galaxies. And this is a technique which is, I think, ultimately going to overtake, for instance, galaxy surveys. In power. It's a younger technique, which hasn't had as much time to flourish and grow, but they're fantastic, the ambitious upcoming surveys, which will extend this to much larger scales here. It's a fantastic technique because lensing is ultimately measuring the metric directly. You don't care if they have visible matter or invisible matter. All matter bends light, and that's what you pick up. So in just 8 years or so, we've come from this confusing mess to this. With all these different techniques, which all agree with each other, and as we're going to see, also agree nicely with some very simple theoretical predictions. And yet, the best is still to come here. There is, for instance, the 21-centimeter tomography technique, which has not detected anything yet, but which will measure this hockey stick curve so well that it might blow away all of this stuff. And there's also much improved measurements coming in all these different areas that I mentioned. This 21-centimeter technique, you can ask me about it afterwards, basically has the property that it can map, it has the potential to map out what's happening in our observable universe from redshift of 7 or so, all the way up to redshift of 50, thereby mapping out a vastly larger volume than what we've been able to do with galaxy surveys here in the middle, or with microwave background, which is sensitive to a thin film on the inside of this sphere here. So there's the ultimate goal of mapping out the whole interior of this is a long way off, but there's a lot of cool things happening here. So that's my summary of the data, what we've measured so far. What do we really know about the physics from this? If you give public outreach talks in Kansas, you'll undoubtedly have some people who've heard claims that the universe was created 4003 BC at 8 in the morning and stuff like that, for instance. So I think when I tell people, if people ask me if I believe in the Big Bang, it's very important that I tell them what I mean by the Big Bang first. What I mean when I say I believe in the Big Bang, which I do, is that our entire observable universe was once as hot as the core of the sun. And it was expanding so fast that it was doubling its size in under a second. For this, I think we have overwhelming evidence. And not a shred of doubt in our mind that this is the case. But it's important to notice, and what this does not imply, I mean, this is bigger than enough of a bang for me to feel it deserves the epithet big. But I'm not saying that there's any evidence for singularity or any such thing. Basically, when you start pushing farther back in time than about a second, our evidence gets much more shaky. This, what we've been able to do so far, is look farther and farther back in time at assortments of evidence, right? And establish that everything we see was doing that. We don't know what happened far beyond in space, and we don't know what happened here in space earlier. Those are the current frontiers of our ignorance. Those are the frontiers of our knowledge. So, last time I chose to highlight a little bit the galaxy clustering measurements because that's something I've spent a lot of time in the last 7 or so years working on. And we talked about how by making maps of the distribution of galaxies and comparing them with theoretical predictions, we can ultimately measure the metric and fit parameters of various sorts. This here shows progress we've made in mapping larger volumes. So in 2003, my collaborators and I in the Sloan Digital Sky Survey did a big analysis of galaxies, which got a fair bit of attention. But that was just mapping on this little piece. And what we finished this year, in this paper which came out in December, was mapping all this much deeper volume with these luminous red galaxies that you see down here. And clearly, the larger the volume we can map, the more accurate the measurements are that one can make. And you look at history, you can go just from galaxy surveys now, from 1999 to when the PSTZ redshift survey started. Can't show the modern answer, but with bigger error bars. To what we have now, it's really remarkable how the error bars have been shrinking down, thanks to very, very hard work by a lot of people involving Glenn Rose.
Which curve is the vanilla rule in that?
So the simple vanilla prediction is the red curve, but you'll notice that there's, even though these two curves have the same shape, they have different amplitudes. That's because of something known as bias, whereby it's well known that the different types of galaxies, generally, what you would love to measure is how the matter in the universe is clustered. But what you do with a galaxy survey is you measure how what you can see is clustered. And the general theoretical prediction is that on very, very large scales, on scales much larger than the range of the complicated astrophysics that goes on, any objects will have a power spectrum of the same shape. But there's an unknown amplitude, which you basically have to treat as an unknown and margin fit for it and marginalize out. That's one of the reasons why I'm so optimistic about gravitational lensing, because they don't have this sort of uncertainty. Like you're just directly probing the metric. The microwave background, it's of course an area which I've also had a lot of fun working on personally, with often together with experimentalists who took the data. And the measurements of galaxy power spectra and microwave background complement each other very, very well. Here I'm showing you a compilation of microwave background measurements in black from across the world, both for unpolarized stuff and the sort of galaxy power spectra we spoke of. Don't worry too much about the units and stuff here. Just remember, black is measurement, red is theory. Okay? And this is stuff that I put up on my webpage because I find it useful in teaching. You can find it all there if you want to play these movies at your leisure. What this illustrates is here, for instance, why we say that space is approximately flat. Because if you go change the curvature of space, you see that only when the curvature parameter is such is very, very close to zero, you actually fit the data. Otherwise, peaks in the micro background are in the wrong place. The physics of that is that if you draw a triangle on the board here, the angles are going to add up 180 degrees. If you draw a triangle on the surface of an orange, the angles are going to add up to more than 180 degrees. Angles look bigger. All these structures in the micro background look larger, which corresponds to a sideways shift of this whole pattern.
Max?
Yeah?
Can you make a stronger statement that, if you choose another value of omega k, that there's no way to fit the all three curves by adjusting the other parameters?
That's a great question. The answer is no, that's not true. Even though many people have glibly forgotten to mention that and published papers saying we have proved the universe is flat. Because look at this, I'm now going to change the amount of dark energy. Here's the answer to your question, Lee. See? This is also doing nothing to any of the heights of the peak, just shifting sideways over here. It's what we call a degeneracy, right? And the physics of this is very easy to understand. Clearly, you can shift the angle of my hockey stick as it depends by curving space in the room, but you can also shift the angle as it depends by changing the distance between you and the hockey stick. And that's exactly what dark energy does. It affects the expansion history and puts more distance between you and the last scattering surface. So it's not true that with distance EMB, for instance, you can actually measure both of those things. Fortunately, this degeneracy comes in a different way here than it does there, basically because these are a very different distance from these. So even though you can fool the micro background perfectly by doing what we discussed, you cannot actually fool both together. So 1+1 is bigger than 2. These two different techniques really complement each other nicely. So that's a very, very important question, actually. This issue of degeneracies, which has often been swept under the rug a little too much. I'm glad you aired it.
If you have baryons, just baryons, and no compound matter.
Yes?
And a large lambda, you have one. And neutrinos, you can fit the first, second peak. But you lose the third peak.
So,
because it's still trapped.
That's correct. However, unless you also do some other radical change to the theory of gravity, you will fail to get the galaxies right. This is exactly what we're looking at now. I'm keeping the total amount of matter fixed, and I'm changing the fraction of it, which is baryonic relative to dark, okay? So on the right hand side, I can run this a little bit slower to make it a little bit easier to see. Now the amount of dark matter will eventually be zero. And you see, if you have all baryons and no dark matter, you still do a reasonable job over here, especially if you adjust some other parameters, but you make about a factor of 30 or so too little power in the galaxy distribution. This is because of a process called silk damping, which erases fluctuations when the universe is about 1,000 times smaller than now in the matter distribution. So our galaxy wouldn't even have formed if you didn't change anything else also. And for measuring parameters like that, again, it very much helps having multiple tools that you can use for the measurements. This is what happens when you keep the matter fraction fixed and instead change something else, the fraction which is neutrinos, or hot dark matter. It doesn't do much at all to micro background, but having all neutrinos, again, really, really poisons the clustering of galaxies. The basic reason for that is that if I throw this thing up here with a speed exceeding 11.2 kilometers per second, that's the escape velocity from Earth, it won't come back, right? If I throw it with 300 kilometers per second, it'll even escape from our galaxy. And neutrinos are typically moving faster than that in these models these days. So neutrinos cannot be gravitationally bound in galaxy halos and help them form.
I've done calculations and you find that another thing you get fixed is capital G.
Yeah, so you're quite right. I have to preface this. I should tell you explicitly what's being assumed here. In calculating these particular movies, I'm not doing the fully general thing. This is assuming that standard general relativity is correct, at least in the weak field limit. And also assuming that standard plasma physics is correct. Those are assumptions being made. We don't know that standard general relativity is correct. And I think I think that the type of study of alternative gravity models that you and others are doing is extremely important. And in fact, even the proof of that is I even spent time thinking about things like that myself, right? So I'm not saying that there is no way of modifying gravity to get rid of dark matter. I'm just saying that if you assume general relativity, then this is what happens. And the basic thing I wanted, there's going to be a short quiz after you leave of exactly how each parameter affects each wiggle. Now, seriously, the key thing I want to take you to take away from this is, of course, just that there are a lot of parameters, okay, and they tend to affect, each tends to affect these curves in different ways, with a few exceptions corresponding to these degeneracies that Lee mentioned, right? So if you measure this and this really, really well, you can back out joint measurements of these parameters. And I think, rather than dwelling further on this, let me focus a little bit on what has been learned first from this exercise, and then we'll back off and talk about more general things again, as what we ultimately have learned and what the unknowns are. So there are a lot of parameters you can measure and get distributions for and stuff, and since we're focusing more on parameters today, I have my illegible version of this that I'm going to put here if anyone actually wants to take one up and take with you, with all these parameters. I've tried to make this rather useful because it actually contains all the definitions of the parameters in terms of the ones here at the top, which are the only independent ones, and all the other ones are just derived algebraically from those. I think the basic message as 2007 or 2006 is where we stand is summarized by this eminent book that I've been reading a lot of recently. We used to be able to fit all of cosmology with five parameters. Now we need six parameters to fit everything. And the newcomer is the so-called spectral index from inflation. We can no longer, at least at the two sigma or so level, just assume that we had scale invariant fluctuations to start with. Seems to be a little bit of a departure from that. And what are the parameters that we measure that are on this piece of paper that you can get? Well, there are the cosmic matter budget parameters, which tell you basically this, what the universe is made up of. There are these seed fluctuation parameters. So we recall early on, something, inflation, quantum fluctuations, or something else, created these seed fluctuations that are there. They have a very boring power spectrum, as far as we can tell. None of these fancy wiggles or anything. The first approximation is just the scale invariant spectrum of amplitude around 10 to the minus 5, but also with a little bit of a tilt. That's now we are 6, that parameter, which would be 1.0 if it were scale invariant. And these are the only parameters on this list that you actually need. Then you need three matter budget parameters only. There's no evidence in cosmology for neutrino masses, even though we know from supercamera canon that they're there. No evidence at all that the dark energy is anything other than a lambda, simple cosmological constant fits at all. There's absolutely no evidence for curvature of space, no evidence for scalar modes, or for any second derivative in this curve. In addition to those five, there's also an irritating parameter to do with when the first star is formed, which is degenerate with these, and also therefore has to be measured, even though it's not really so fundamental. And I mentioned for you yesterday the basic history of the universe, when key events took place. And from these basic six parameters that you need, or some additional optional ones, you can then derive a whole bunch of others by just simple mathematical relations, which I summarized here. Like all these capital omega guys, like the Hubble parameter at the present time, and various other things. And there's a boatload of different parameters people talk a lot about that are just simple functions of the fundamental ones. The ones which I think are most relevant to talk about here at the perimeter are the ones which have to do with fundamental physics, which tell us something about the universe. Ironically, almost none of the parameters that a cosmologist normally talk about are actually things that tell us about the universe. omega, matter, H, and things like that. They're all these glorified time variables. In fact, if you look at the universe as it ages, this parameter gets smaller and smaller and gradually approaches zero. And so does this. So saying what they are is just telling us what time it is now when we humans come on the scene. So instead, as physicists, what's much more interesting to do is to take certain combinations of these parameters, which really are properties of the universe that have nothing to do with a particular epoch, but you measure them. And that's what I'm showing you here. And again, this little cheat sheet shows you how to get these fundamental ones out of it, what people usually talk about, and vice versa. So what are those? The five fundamental parameters we need, there's the one called Q, the density fluctuation altitude, which is about 10 to minus 5. It's in fact about 2 times 10 to minus 5. But then we definitely need the dark energy density. If it's constant, it's just the property of the universe, right? It's about 10 to the minus 123 in Planck units. For some reason, people keep saying 120. I hate this habit of rounding off the exponents to the nearest 10. It's as easy to remember the truth as 1, 2, 3. And then for the omegas, matter budget, what properties of the universe are how much baryons you have per photon, a little less than 1 electron volt, and how much dark matter or whatever that is per photon, which is about 3 electron volts. That does not evolve with time. The density of it drops, like 8 to minus 3, but so does the number density of photons, right? So these are just constants. The neutrinos, likewise. The curvature of the universe is consistent with being zero. The fundamental thing you can measure is this parameter, which is 10th, which is 1 point, which is consistent with zero, as you can see with these error bars, and no bigger magnitude than about 10 to minus 61. This is all of these are dimensionless numbers. This is a dimensionless number. The reason it's so small is exactly what we mean by the flatness problem in cosmology. And we only need these five parameters then in cosmology, which are then to be added to the 26 that we need to do all the standard model of particle physics. So far, if you want to just parameterize your measurements of the universe, you need a total of 30. Well, actually, you need 32 numbers altogether, 6 for cosmology, 26 for the rest. And it would be really, really nice if someone in this room can figure out some data compression for deriving some of those numbers in terms of others. Let me, in addition to bombarding you with numbers, just show mine graphically a few things about how things have improved. Yesterday, I already told you about how the measurements of dark matter density versus ordinary matter have tightened up tremendously. And we now have measured both of these numbers with reasonably good precision. And let's come back to talking about the bullet cluster and what dark matter is, perhaps, or not, is not. Later on. For neutrinos, as you saw from these movies, you just use the micro background. You cannot put any bound, really, a really strong bound on the neutrino fraction. But when you put together that with galaxy clustering and polarization measurements.
Those curves are neutrino masses?
Yeah, these things here correspond to lines of constant neutrino mass. And the bottom line to take away from it is that the data is much better again and put pretty tight upper bounds. And what's really interesting about the future of this is that the ultimate limits that we should be able to get from cosmology, especially from gravitational lensing plus better CMB in 5-10 years, are about 0.03 electron volts. That's the upper limit, which coincidentally is in the same ballpark as where the truth must lie, because the lower bounds of particle physics are like 0.04, 0.05. So it's pretty much guaranteed that unless the funding gets cut off, that one should eventually see neutrino signatures in the sky. It would be really fascinating. To get all the way down to 0.03, I would say that'd be 10 years or so. And then in terms of inflation, I showed you yesterday already the constraints on omega matter versus omega lambda, and how the curvature of space has been constrained to be within a percent or so of no curvature at all, which corresponds to 1, which is a remarkable success for one prediction that inflation has made. But inflation has also made predictions which have not yet been tested. So it makes Karl Popper happy in the sense that it's sticking its head out. And for instance, the very simplest inflation model you can write down, where the instant potential is just a parabola, which Andre Linde is a big fan of, it makes a particular prediction that this scalar spectral index should be 0.96. And this so-called tension to scalar ratio, where it talks about gravitational fluctuations generated relative to others, is 0.16. So the predictor should be here. And then there are other models that stick their head out and predict other things. And then the data has come closing in. It's gotten better and better. And I think it's really quite remarkable. It's finally, 25 years after inflation was invented, data has gotten good enough that it started to bump up against theories. And for the first time in the last year or two, the theories have actually started to get chilled. And most of the time was spent getting sensitivity down by many, many orders of magnitude. And now finally, the exciting stuff that we've been waiting for is happening. And it's quite striking that, for example, this simple thing is still allowed, but that the sensitivity forecast from if you combine the Planck satellite measurements, which that's going to be launched in 2008, with the completed SDSS, for instance, these are the sort of error bars that you would get. So that if this is the truth, you should be able to rule out everything again except that, right? And if that happened, then I think some people would get very happy.
At
least, yeah.
If you want to insist that the spectral index is 1, can you do it with running? Can you match the present data with running?
If you want the spectral index to be 1, you can do that if you have... The easiest way to do that is to have to go upward. See, you can miss the spectral index of 1 here. You just need to have a lot of gravitational waves. But then you have to ask, you still need inflation then to make the gravitational waves, probably. So the combination of n equals 1 and no gravitational waves is really not fitting the data at this point, which is very interesting.
Well, that's about 2 sigma.
It's about 2 sigma to have any running. Yeah, there are a lot of, whether that's 2 sigma or 3 sigma, there are a lot of interesting issues there, as you know. There's been an interesting point made that the WMAP team didn't model point sources quite good enough, and there are a few options they had in the analysis pipeline they could have done one way or the other. I think the interesting thing to do is to wait and see what experiments like Planck come in and say, because this is going to be done much better quite soon. The really important thing, I think, is we've waited decades while the data were still at orders of magnitude away in sensitivity from where the theory predictions were. Right? And now contact has been made, right? They're bumped up, and there's going to be real clarity. There's going to be a lot of interesting stuff learned about this.
So, if you identify things which are 2 sigma.
Say that again?
If you identify 2 sigma results, wouldn't you agree that what these really want, what the data really wants, is actually scaling invariance and then regression?
Well, as I said, I'm not going to bet, my firstborn child on that this is ruled out. To me, the interesting thing is more the longer view. Data has started to bump up against theory. And in a few years, we're really going to know a lot of stuff about what the heck is going on here. That's what's important. I don't get too excited about putting bets on whether this is really ruled out yet or not.
But the point I'm making is actually the thing wants deviations from n equals 1, but basically a fact at a small scale, it's not at large scale.
Yeah, Joao, I totally agree with you that it's very intriguing, particularly what's happening on large scales there. If this is something both you and I have spent a lot of time just agonizing about what the heck is going on. So I try to keep a very open mind about that. I'm sure you do too. But I think the key thing, again, I want you all to take away from it is that finally, the two-decade wait for this kind of data is over. And there should be a lot of interesting news coming in here in the next couple of years from the medical side. So I think this is actually a good point to just wrap up. And look a little bit toward the future, it's, you know, it's tough to make predictions, right, especially about the future. And it's often attributed to Yogi Berra. I've also heard it attributed to Niels Bohr. So what about the future? I said last time that when I was in grad school, and you know, as a postdoc, the future was trying to measure the parameters. Well, that's done now, reasonably well. So now what? Are we finished? Because if we are, we cosmologists really do need to look for something else to do. And I'm just going to give you my own very personal answer to where I think the future lies. I love burritos. But I think the really exciting question for me has always been not to measure the number, but to ask what it all means about physics. And since the data is getting so much better, we finally have the opportunity to start testing assumptions rather than just buying into one part of it. In the spirit, for instance, of testing gravity, testing whether dark matter really exists, whether dark energy is, et cetera, et cetera. So let me say just a few words about where I think, what I think are some exciting things to look forward to for dark question of dark matter, dark energy, and the early universe. For dark energy, here's my summary. I think it's important to note that we still have no observed departures from vanilla, from plain vanilla, cosmological constant. So the million-dollar question for the observers is the search for any kind of departure from constant, either in time or in space. And on the theory side, as you know, there's zillions of papers and models, and it's wide open. Could be its cosmological constant, some ground state energy, some abundant scalar field, maybe it's modified gravity. Cosmological constant is something where it's been demonstrated in more than one way you can do it with modified gravity, although then you again often have problems explaining the coincidence problem. And then there's the anthropic business that gets into that. So a lot of active arguments going on the theory side. On the observation side, there's one question only, which is it constant? For dark matter, the theory situation is pretty similar, actually. There's zillions of papers and models for dark matter, and it's wide open. Some people think it's a particle, a wimp. Some people think it's an axion. There have been a lot of attempts to see if we could do it with modified gravity. I think it's very important that all of these avenues be pursued. We don't know what the truth is. And we should look everywhere. Regardless of what it is, there's also this question of why does its density happen to be comparable to that of baryons, which ultimately we would like to have some sort of explanation for as well. And on the observational side, again, there's so far no observed departure from just plain vanilla dark matter, by which now I mean just a massive particle which is very cold and doesn't interact with anything else much, and is derived. And the whole thing is just described by this one parameter, its density. Right now, one parameter is enough to describe dark energy, its constant, and one parameter is enough to describe dark matter. But there are a lot of cool ways in which we might be able to detect departures from vanilla. In cosmology, the power spectrum, which was shaped roughly like this, in the vanilla dark matter scenario, you make the firm prediction that this curve does not change its shape over time, just its amplitude. So the universe gets clumpier and clumpier, but the power spectrum retains its shape. This is something we can and must test observationally. If it changes its shape a little bit, if dark matter is a particle, it could tell us about whether it's warm dark matter, whether there's a viscosity or a dispersion or sound speed in that substance. That's also a very nice way of looking for neutrino masses, which predict the change in shape. Then there is, of course, direct detection, where, as you know, a lot of ambitious experimentalists across the world are trying to catch dark matter particles as they fly through the lab, and some Italians claim they found them, and then some others claim that they're wrong, and they have spirited discussions about that. And then there's the possibility of producing dark matter particles in Geneva when the LHC turns on, at least finding supersymmetries. And then there's very exciting prospects also for indirect detection, where, as you know, there's a number of rather puzzling signals that have been found, like electron-positron annihilation in the galactic center, seen with integral and other things. And the GLAST satellite, which is about going to be launched fairly soon, should really shed light also on whether we have evidence for dark matter there. And there's also interesting things with substructure, which many people here, like you, have been looking at. So I think there's a lot of promising breakthroughs. A lot of breakthroughs that really could happen in the next 5 years. And I'm quite optimistic that at least one of them is going to happen. For the early universe, again, it used to be, up until a year ago, that you could say vanilla rules. All you knew about the early universe could be summarized by one number, the amplitude of this power spectrum. And now, albeit as you point out, Joe, maybe only at the two sigma level, maybe you need two parameters, or maybe there's something else funny going on. Here again, history repeats itself. There's zillions of papers and models, kind of wide open on the theory side, and we'll try to come up with ways of realizing inflation. In my opinion, a very embarrassing problem also is that inflation never seems to stop. It seems to produce many different regions. And as soon as you have an inflaton potential, even if there's only one inflaton potential that's not symmetric, if you roll down from the left or from the right, you make two different values of this fluctuation amplitude. You know, so how do you predict what we have here? If you're going to get some statistical prediction, you have to at least be able to compute your probabilities. And this is a very embarrassing issue, I think, the measure problem. It's totally unsolved. So lots of work on the theory side. On the experimental side, again, I think the buzzword is look for departures from vanilla. Look for more information from Mother Nature. And there are four different kinds of departures from vanilla. It's talked about a lot. There's the departure from scale invariants, which may have been seen now. There is finding these gravitational waves, which have not been found, but which could easily be found by Planck, for example. There is departures from so-called Gaussianity, and then there's so-called isocurvature modes. And a funny thing I noticed with Matthias Aldariaga when we tried to do a confusing table summarizing the literature on this is that even though there's a whole zoo of models out there for inflation, every single one that we found predicted at least one kind of departure from vanilla. So I think by measuring things better, there is, again, a real prospect of finding out more from nature. So that's my quick summary of where things stand and why the universe is a happy place for cosmology. Thanks.
The up to a redshift of about 0.3, we have a nonlinear regime.
Yes.
The galaxies and the inhorting units. If you solve exact solutions of Einstein's equations, not modifying the space,
yes,
then you can show that it's possible to get acceleration of the universe with dissipates. You have to do an average.
Are you referring to the work of Kolb and Ryotta?
Well, myself and others have published exact solutions of Einstein's equations. And Rachel told me why you
didn't. No. Are you arguing that their results are correct or wrong?
Well, the results, the idea is correct. The method they use is wrong. So, this is the only way I've seen to solve the physics problem. Is if you remove the galaxies and voids,
yeah,
you wouldn't see any acceleration.
Do you have any time to tell me about that this afternoon?
Yeah.
I would love to talk more about it.
Secondly, you made the point that, yes, the advantage in the statement, because of the surface of the last sketch, you will never see directly what happens near the big crack.
With photons.
Maybe with gravitational waves, but you still have to detect them. You don't have to detect them.
Even neutrinos actually let you see substantially farther back than this.
But we can't see to 5/10.
That's right. That's right.
Chaotic inflation of 5 squared is there. So what if there's another model gives you the same fitting for the date namely flatness and spectral index of the dark matter. How would you know the difference between one and the other? I have an alternative model, by the way, just say there is this one.
If we have two self-consistent mathematical theories that both fit all the data, I think we have no way of knowing it. The difference.
This gets to your point, and this brings to the point at the top. There are things we can't see.
Right. Right.
But we do the physics.
So I think.
Maybe we can talk about.
So yeah, that's what I would like to suggest because that's very tech.
Okay.
Let's just the job, of course.
Just to elaborate on the question. So forget about the number. Even I'm just looking at the power spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
What the data really wants is actually on large scales in around one, then running on small scales around 0.9 or something like that. Face value, you actually don't want even a constant n. So the problem is that actually is running as you go through the state, you find it's running when you go from one data set to another data set, which raises the issue of systematics. But at this point, it's not so much counting parameters, you're actually not making the same, you're taking C and B intercepts and large scale structured intercepts, and you're mixing everything. Which makes me think that another alternative that maybe we don't mix at all, which is different things with different systematics. And that maybe N is one, and we'll stop, and there's a problem there.
Yeah, I think your point is well taken. I think. First of all, I generally don't like the approach of taking three different data sets and just putting them together and it comes out. I want to always know where each piece of information really comes from. And before you combine two data sets, you should always ask also, is there anything that they both measure? And then see if that's actually consistent. So in a sense, sort of subtract them from each other and see if you get zero. And that's something we'll get better and better at doing when as the data improves. So I'm all with you on that one. Also, on the theory side, I think you just mentioned what's actually one of my hobby horses, which is that we should talk less about cosmological parameters and more about cosmological functions. Because there are all these parameters, but mostly what they are just parameterizations of simple functions. Like what people often do is they have this curve here, the density is a function of scale, and they would say, let's assume it's a quartic polynomial. And then the zero thing is the dark energy, right? And then there's the matter. Which has slope 3, and then the photons give us the quadratic slope 2 part, etc. Let's just measure them with a dark curve without assuming anything and see what it looks like, right? And for your question, I think it's very analogous. We would love to measure the primordial power spectrum. And you're saying, you know, maybe in fact it looks like this, maybe it's not a straight line, maybe it's not a polynomial. What people usually do is assume it's a parabola and parameterize it by an amplitude, a spectral index, and alpha. But before I parameterize a curve by anything, I want to look at the curve and see is this a good parameterization. And finally, I think the measurements are getting good enough that we will become able to start doing this kind of stuff. And I would love to just see better non-parametric reconstruction plots of these various curves. There aren't that many curves. There's the expansion history, right? And then for the clustering history, I want to look at the growth factor as a function of time. And then for the seed fluctuations, you would like to look at this scalar power spectrum initially, and if we can measure it, also the tensor power spectrum initially. So measuring these cosmological functions directly, I think, is going to be a very good way of testing whether even the whole hypotheses we make are right.
Last question.
Yeah, well, maybe you don't want to do this, but I'm curious about where your views are about Lowell stuff these days.
Oof, that's a difficult one. I basically, I'm very confused. I remember very vividly when Angelic and I, way back, were sitting trying to clean out foregrounds from this map and thinking that since people have talked so much about the low quadrupole, I was thinking, what does the quadrupole actually look like spatially? So we had finally made an all sky map where we compute the quadrupole. We made a plot of it, and it looked kind of anemic and also very planar. So then I had that program, and Angelica got to bed, so I thought, I'll look at the octopole. And it looked completely weird. It was in the same plane and all planar, and moreover, it seemed to be aligned. And then many people since then Angelica and Joao and many others have looked much more carefully at that and found these very puzzling, seemingly puzzling things. And I'm very much confused about what it all means, frankly. I can just give you a summary of different things people say. Like some people think it's just a fluke, albeit maybe a big one. But some people think that it's telling us something about funny inflation. Some people think it's just, there's really almost no power there, and it's all foregrounds causing the alignments. And I just try to keep an open mind.
Okay.
So what would you say are the experimental prospects for measuring the temporal moments?
I would say they're wonderful. I think for some reason there's a lot of people in the community who have come to this gloomy conclusion that the amplitude must be 10 to the minus 2 or something like that. And that you need to wait until 2020 until you have any chance of seeing it. And it was precisely to counteract that gloomy feeling that I decided to just plot for you. This. But you see that again, if I just ask my son, my 5-year-old Alexander, to draw an intercom potential, and I say, I'm going to calculate the predictions for that simple model, you know, I'm going to get something typically which Planck will easily see. That's not saying that that's the truth. There are many models you can construct where you get, where it's hard to tell. But I think I'd say there's a good 50% chance that we will actually find them in a few years. And that, to me, is going to be an absolutely momentous shift in our entire understanding of cosmology, because whereas it's actually very complicated to interpret the 10 to the minus 5 number in terms of what happened here, because it depends both on the amplitude height of this curve and on the derivative. The tensor mode is very different. The amplitude there is just telling you the energy scale inflation directly. So if you can measure that whole curve, you're actually measuring exactly this curve, it turns out, so the units relabeled, which would be absolutely fantastic. We can measure at the present time what this curve is doing and then go all the way down to here. So I think it's going to be very exciting to see what Planck satellites and other polarization experiments find in the next 3 to 5 years.
So thank you very much for the great talk. Here, it's no secret, as part of the screen, we do is hear the whole day's coming and probably look for
the back. Not a lot of really great questions.